manager based in New York City. You can get details at democracynow.org. And a very belated happy birthday to Dina Guzder. Special thank you to the Vermont PBS team here in Colchester, Dave Rice, Holt Albee, Sarah Wentworth, Stephen Weigel, Mike Dunn, Brian Stevenson, Keith Swan, Josh Seekard, and Dana Napomic, as well as Democracy Now!'s Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton, and Libby Rainey. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alcock, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Charina Nadura, Tamere Astudio, Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman from Vermont PBS. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 and 12 seconds. Coming up next is KBOO Evening News.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society's concert season. On Friday, November 30th, the PFS concert features Patrick Ball and the Legends of the Celtic Harp in their program titled A Winter Gift. These three famed harpers perform Celtic legends and weave English and Irish literature with rare pieces of holiday music. The concert and storytelling event is at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele in Portland, at 7:30 p.m. On January 18th next year, the Northwest band True North will bring their folk and bluegrass stylings to the PFS stage. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The festivities for the 50th anniversary of KBOO are going on. We are hosting a Latinx Peña and open house at Studio One here at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland. We are celebrating 30 plus years of Latinx contributions to KBOO with poetry, music, performance, and food. If you cannot get here to the live event, you can listen starting at 8 p.m. at kboo.fm or on the KBOO app. Our Latinx Peña Open House will be on the air for 4 hours, starting at 8 p.m. till midnight. Call us at KBOO Studios for your shout-outs at 503-231-8187.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a major earthquake hits Anchorage, Alaska.
The Portland mayor meets with the FBI.
And in international news, the G20 group meets in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 30th, 2018. I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. President Trump joined world leaders today in Buenos Aires at the G20 Economic Group meeting. According to the BBC, Argentina's President Mauricio Macri, hosting the meeting, said the solution was, quote, dialogue, dialogue, and dialogue, end quote, and called for a clear message of shared responsibility. President Trump, however, had already canceled his dialogue with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Massive security forces were evident on the streets of Buenos Aires as the meeting got underway. The G20 nations account for the 80% of the world's economic output. Protesters facing austerity measures from the new right-wing president in Argentina filled the streets near the meeting, decrying the amount of money already spent to hold the summit.
White flight, gentrification, and the urban church are the topics of a lecture that's open to the public at Warner Pacific University in Portland next week. Dr. Lloyd Chia, who teaches social science, will explore the relationships between urbanization, gentrification, wealth, racial injustice, and faith. According to the university, during the era of white flight to the suburbs, many churches chose to follow their wealthier white members out to the suburbs in the name of needing, quote, more space, propelling the megachurch movement of the 70s and 80s. Chia's lecture draws attention to how the church failed to work in the best interest of urban communities that needed it most during that time. He says now, churches are once again following the money back into the city centers. While many churches are motivated by a desire to impact cities for good, they can also be part of the gentrifying process, displacing minorities and transforming neighborhoods. You can hear Dr. Chia speak on the Urban Church as Fairweather Friend on Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. in the Schlatter Chapel at Warner Pacific University on Southeast 68th Avenue in Portland.
A massive earthquake struck Anchorage, Alaska today. The airport, rail lines, and several traffic arteries were closed as officials assessed the damage. A tsunami alert was canceled after a few tense hours this morning following the first trembler and aftershock. Longtime Portland activist and KABU volunteer Martha Odom now lives in Anchorage, Alaska, where KABU's Teresa Mitchell called her to get a firsthand account of the earthquake.
Hello.
Martha Odom, you are a longtime Portland activist, a member of the Raging Grannies, an anti-imperialist of long standing, and you've moved to Anchorage, Alaska, just in time to experience an earthquake.
I'm a Portland expat in exile. It's still home to me.
Well, what was the quake like? What part of Anchorage are you in?
I am in the southeast. The quake was really scary. My house has stuff strewn all over, plants on the floor, empty dirt out. As far as I can tell, there's no major structural damage. Gas lines here are all underground, and in my backyard is the structure that provides gas, heating, cooking to in for my neighbors. And the gas service might get shut off while they check for leaks. But
do you smell gas where you were at?
I don't.
Did the water pipes break, or the sewer pipes?
No, water pipes are good, and the electricity stayed on. That's all underground, which is no guarantee, but apparently it works. I had grabbed my go bag, ID, and phone and went outside and came back in just as a 5.8 aftershock hit, which...
About how far are you from the Anchorage city center?
City center in Anchorage, I'm guessing 5 miles.
5 miles away. Have you been hearing about a tsunami threat?
Heard one early warning about tsunami, and then it was canceled. And there's very little danger that I would be impacted. But the 5.7 aftershock was 6 minutes later.
It must really jangle your nerves to have the ground shake a second time.
I'm normally a pretty calm person, but right now I have so much adrenaline racing through me that...
I heard that the TV station went off the air. Is there community radio there in Anchorage?
No. And one of the dismal things about being here, no community radio. And unless you're looking for religion, you're not going to find much stations. Yesterday, I turned on local news on the TV and turned it off because it was just annoying as hell. It really is an information wasteland or worse here.
Well, so you may be concerned then that your gas will be shut off, which must be... Do you rely on gas for the heating?
Heating is... I have heat and stoves that are gas, but I have a fireplace. I have a small electric heater. I have camping equipment.
What was it like for you when the quake first hit?
It was sort of this instant shift into emergency mode. I do keep a go bag that is pretty important. I didn't have ID or phone in it. I grabbed the heavy winter coat and the sleeping bag and went outside because I figured if something's going to collapse, I'd rather be there.
Are you hearing anything about emergency response there in Anchorage?
right after, there were lots of sirens all around. The school district posted that all students are safe and parents could pick them up whenever they felt safe. I don't have any posts from emergency services that I can see. I get posts from the fire department.
What did it break in your house? Did it break things in your kitchen?
Lots of plants are on the floor, dumped out dirt all over. Lots of stuff from shelves is on the floor and broken. Drawers are open. My desk has an unattached big oak shelf on the top, and it was turned over with everything in it spilled out. My little shelves for gardening stuff, there was a quart jug of fish emulsion, which got knocked over and broke, so my house smells like dead fish.
Huh.
But house is a mobile home, and definitely mobile home, not trailer. But it's old. It's like 1987. And I always worry about aging structures. I did a couture, and it seems like all its essential pieces are intact. I haven't really heard from people elsewhere in Anchorage, but right around my little patch of it, everything seems to be relatively okay.
Well, thank you very much for that information, and I think people will be glad to know that you're relatively safe. I'm sorry to hear that you have a heck of a cleanup to do.
Oh, yeah. Housekeeping is not my long suit. Send love to my Portland family. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye. For KBOO Portland, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
Earlier this month, Oregon voters passed ballot measure 102 by a 10-point margin. This will change the Oregon Constitution and, for the first time, allow municipal bond funds to build privately owned affordable housing complexes. Reporting by Willamette Week last Wednesday, however, raises serious questions about outsourcing the care of vulnerable citizens to private corporations. For example, Multnomah County taxpayers pay Janus Youth Programs nearly $1 million a year to operate an emergency youth shelter. Their contract requires that the shelter remain open around the clock and serve as a last resort for vulnerable kids. However, the corporation has a hard time maintaining staff and often shutters the shelter. This got the county's attention after a Portland youth found the shelter closed and was then assaulted while trying to sleep under a bridge. Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Myron says that the county hasn't revoked the corporation's contract because it doesn't know who else would do the work. The passage of Oregon Ballot Measure 102 allows public money to be spent on private affordable housing. The accountability part remains unclear.
Investigative reporting by the Oregonian reveals that the cost for security guards at City Hall has increased dramatically under Mayor Wheeler. In 2016, private security guards at City Hall cost taxpayers under $200,000. Under Mayor Wheeler, this expense jumped to over $800,000. Wheeler's office said the increased spending is needed to protect elected officials and that private security is cheaper than police.
The Multnomah Neighborhood Association is appealing Portland's middle housing policy, which was introduced in the city's most recent comprehensive development plan. This controversial policy was an 11th-hour addition and would give developers the green light to replace single-family homes with quadruplexes. In briefs filed with the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Multnomah Neighborhood Association raises four issues: the lack of adequate information to inform citizens, a lack of demonstrated need or a factual basis for the policy, the failure to plan in a comprehensive manner, and the lack of adequate response to public input. The judge in the case, Stephen Shipsey, has given the Multnomah Neighborhood Association and the city until December 26th to file opening statements.
It's 5:13 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Someone needs to buy a Grassroots USA tour package for the members of Donald Trump's Council of Economic Advisors so they can at least visit the real world one time in their lives. The three advisors are ivory tower ideologues whose sole professional expertise seems to be twisting reality to fit their boss's right-wing fantasia. In July, for example, the trio issued a fairy tale disguised as an official government report on poverty, essentially asserting that our U.S. of A. no longer has a poverty problem. Poof, declared these learned ones from on high, the need for food stamps, Medicaid, public housing, and other assistance has virtually disappeared in our land. Jobs abound, they lectured. The economy is pumping out great gobs of new wealth, and bluebirds of happiness are spreading joy everywhere. You can imagine the comfort that this report has brought to the 45 million Americans now living below the poverty line. That line means they're trying to make ends meet on only $25,000 a year. Not per person, but for a family of four. Let's see any of Trump's advisors try to live on that before smugly claiming that poverty is largely over. What's at work here is the political manipulation of statistics to support Trump's ideological delusion that poor people are losers who are addicted to safety net programs. As a narcissistic son of privilege, he is out to cut those programs and to impose strict work requirements on families seeking public assistance. Never mind that most recipients of aid already work, subjected to the hardships of poverty by the low wages of their jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, but that's the real world, and it doesn't mesh with Trump and company's cruel self-deception that basic humane benefits make poverty too pleasant. They're imposing a Dickensian governing ethic that is fundamentally obscene, and even more obscene, it's un-American.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin at 5:30. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. And then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather calls for steady rain and a low of around 42. Tomorrow will also be, wait for it, rainy with a high temperature in the mid-40s. Today in history, in 1999, several hundred anti-World Trade Organization activists arrived in Seattle near the convention center and began to take control of key intersections in what became known as the Battle of Seattle. The quote of the day is from Senator Bernie Sanders, who said, quote, "I believe when we stand together, when we share the vision that government should work for all of us, there is nothing we can't accomplish."
The trade deal known as NAFTA 2.0 has been signed by the United States, Canada, and Mexico at the G20 summit. But critics say the deal is another giveaway to large corporations while stomping on the rights of workers and the environment. It replaces the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, when it was signed in 1994, sparked the Zapatista Rebellion, who called the trade agreement death to indigenous people. The new deal, called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, comes after more than a year of negotiations. The Council of Canadians noted that in the closed-door negotiations of the USMCA, corporations came up with new rights for themselves. These included powers for corporations to monitor and change regulations before they are public in areas that could affect food, safety, chemicals, environmental regulations, and other matters of public safety. Senator Bernie Sanders said the deal consists of outrageous giveaways to the fossil fuel industry and big pharmaceutical companies. Signed by Trump today, the agreement still needs to go to Congress for approval.
Today, the Trump administration decided to allow marine creatures, such as whales and dolphins, to be harmed by companies searching for potential oil and gas reserves off the Atlantic coast. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has granted five operators permission to, quote, incidentally but not intentionally harass marine mammals while they are conducting surveys for fossil fuels in the seabed. The testing will involve the use of seismic air guns, which fire continuous blasts to ascertain whether deposits of oil or gas are present. This procedure is a precursor to what could be the first drilling in federal waters off the U.S. eastern seaboard in decades. By the federal government's own estimates, air gun testing could harm hundreds of thousands of marine mammals. Of particular concern is the endangered North Atlantic right whale, with only around 440 individuals left, including fewer than 100 breeding females. Scientists have warned that the extreme disruption caused by air guns can harm a wide range of aquatic life, including sea turtles, fish, and zooplankton, a critical foundational plank of the ocean food web. The deep water drilling that this testing will lead to is the same kind of last-ditch drilling that led to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010 and the ongoing Taylor oil spill, which has been happening in the Gulf of Mexico for the past 14 years.
A new paper released Friday by researchers at the Political Economy Research Institute, or PERI, shows that financing a single-payer system would cost $5 trillion less than the current system over the next 10 years. This challenges the previous assumption that single-payer would end up costing more. Professor Robert Poland, the lead author of the analysis for PERI, said that based on 2017 U.S. healthcare expenditure figures, the cumulative savings for the first decade operating under Medicare for All would be $5.1 trillion, and that doesn't account for the broader macroeconomic benefits such as increased productivity, greater income equality, and net job creation through lower operating costs for small and medium-sized businesses. The most significant sources of savings from Medicare for All, the researchers found, would come in the areas of pharmaceutical drug costs and administration.
Thousands of Oregonians may be leaving money on the table when it comes to help for health insurance. More than 100,000 Oregonians were estimated to be eligible for subsidies through healthcare.gov in 2018, but did not enroll. Oregonians who do not get health insurance through their job or a program such as the Oregon Health Plan or Medicare may qualify for help paying for 2019 coverage at healthcare.gov, but only until December 15th. That's the deadline to get health insurance for next year. The best way to find out if you qualify for financial assistance is to apply, said Cameron Smith, director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. They went on to say, don't assume you make too much to be eligible. People making about $48,000 or less per year and families of four making about $100,000 or less may get help paying for coverage. Last year, Oregonians who chose plans through healthcare.gov got an average subsidy of $421 per month. To apply, go to healthcare.gov before December 15th.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations leaders and government officials in Canada announced plans Friday to move forward on child welfare legislation. It aims to give First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities more control over the care of their children. In a press conference streamed by the CBC, Indigenous Services Minister Jane Philpott says this is one step in supporting Indigenous families.
This is part of the building blocks, as it were, in that going forward to see strong, healthy, self-reliant First Nations, Inuit governments, Métis governments is ultimately what Canada has been missing. But that will not come about until we acknowledge the great needs to heal families, to rebuild those strong bonds of family, to make sure that children are not ripped away from their language, their culture, their land, and their lineage. And so this is a critical step to supporting families.
Inuit leader Natin Obed says there needs to be provisions to acknowledge past challenges and change the way services have negatively impacted people.
We are hopeful that there will be a section that will acknowledge history, acknowledge the really challenging things such as the residential school period, the lack of self-determination that Indigenous peoples have had over time and all of its permutations. Hopefully there will be provisions around the rights of Indigenous children and how those rights in specific provisions in the Act can have remedy and redress for any violations to those children's rights. There also, hopefully, will be provisions around the self-determination space for First Nations, Inuit, and Métis governance.
Indigenous groups have been co-developing the legislation. Native leaders in support of it hope to have it in the books before Canada's federal election in October 2019. Monument Valley Tribal Park, which spans Utah and Arizona, well known for its mesas and buttes, often seen in photos and movies, closed Thursday. The Navajo Nation's Parks Department authorized the closure. The Navajo Times reports the park was shut down to the public after the group Global Witness was filming without a permit. 50 people reportedly protested the closure. In a YouTube video posted by the group, people joked about the incident, saying they're not a cult and they're there to see what secrets of the past the monuments and people hold. Local Navajo leaders in the area are concerned about the health and safety of the public. The park is on Navajo land and managed by the tribe. It's closed until further notice. Minnesota's governor-elect Tim Walz plans to visit the Red Lake Indian Reservation on Sunday and hold a community listening session. Lieutenant Governor-elect Peggy Flanagan is a citizen of the White Earth Nation. They both have been outspoken about Native American issues, veterans care, education, and health. The event will take place at the Red Lake Nation College. The transition team has started a statewide tour to meet with communities and discuss what priorities to tackle in the next year. The tour is also reportedly seeking members for the administration. The Fort Peck tribes in Montana will not accept a group of bison from Yellowstone National Park. The Billings Gazette reports an attorney for the tribe says there are too many burdensome conditions by the federal government. One concern is disease. The tribe wants more control over disease testing. Relocation efforts are trying to be made to prevent buffalo from being slaughtered. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Back in 2005, Mayor Tom Potter, a former police chief, withdrew Portland from the FBI's so-called Joint Terrorism Task Force, or JTTF. In 2010, the FBI orchestrated a fake bomb scare at Portland's Pioneer Square, and the city, under Mayor Adams and Police Commissioner Saltzman, promptly rejoined the task force. The election earlier this month of Joanne Hardesty, who takes office in January, to the Portland City Council puts withdrawal from the task force back on the table. In fact, a public records request by OPB revealed that Mayor Wheeler met with the FBI 2 days after the election to discuss the terms of a potential pullout of the JTTF, and if the city were to end its participation, how to keep communications open between the FBI and the Portland Police Bureau. This story is still developing. Stay tuned to KABU for continuing coverage.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, November 30th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Teresa Mitchell and Joe Myers. The producer is Teresa Mitchell, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The director of the Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Coming up Monday morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to the Columbia River Keepers about the dangers of the proposed world's largest methanol refinery. At 11, Making Contact looks at efforts to reform local criminal justice systems in an effort to send fewer people to jail. And at 11:30, Madness Radio explores voices and visions from outside mental health. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Linda. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, Jenna. Good night, Jasmine.
Good night, Linda and Jasmine, and good night, KABU Evening News. Well, I guess forever for now, at least for me. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:29 and 20 seconds. Coming up next is Counterspin for all you Super Counterspin fans, and I know you are out there. But while we're waiting for that, just make sure that, you know, you are an invested listener. You're not an invested listener. Guess what? You can go on to KBOO.FM and click on that donate button and become a member today. Because you know what? Listening to Counterspin, when you know that you're supporting what you hear on the air, makes you feel so much even more counterspinnerific. I think that's a word I just made up. But you know what? Counterspin fans, let's use it. Let's go with it. I've had a lot of fun with you all these years. Keep tuning in to your member-supported station, KBOO Community Radio. Okay, as I just teased, guess what? It's Counterspin time.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, has said he supports dictatorship and torture, that religious and ethnic minorities must fit in or simply disappear, that his political opponents should leave or go to jail, that the only problem with Brazil's military dictatorship is that they didn't kill enough people, that police should have carte blanche to kill whoever they like, and that he'd rather his own son be dead